What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Polititeen. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Polititeen podcast, where Damian and I have conversations with people from across the nation talking about public policy, social issues, and things anywhere from racial issues to climate change. Now, today with us, we have Dr. Stephen Roberts, a professor from Stanford University of Psychology. Now, Stephen, if you'd like to introduce yourself for any of our guests today.
Sure, my name is Steve Roberts. I'm a psychologist at Stanford University. I do research on social concepts and how people acquire social biases and how they enact them and enforce them in their everyday lives.
Yeah, and as we do with all our first guests, our first question to you, our first question to you is going to be, how did you get into this field? This is a very interesting and if I can say, unique field. What kind of drove you to this profession?
Yeah, so I think I'm specifically interested in the topic of specifically racial biases and social inequalities. I think because I identify as multiracial, so my dad's black, mom is white. We lived in many different places growing up, from Germany to Italy, Texas, New York. And what was always really striking to me is how you go through different contexts, different places, and people think about race very differently. The biases are very differently. The hierarchies are very different. And that always stood out to me. And I think I was always just kind of curious in how do people form racial categories? Why am I perceived differently across different contexts? Why are people treated differently across different contexts? So I've kind of always had that curiosity for as long as I can remember. Now, psychology specifically, I'll spare you the long details, but I was an undergrad at New York University, and I took this class on history of education, and someone came in, he was a professor at NYU, but he did his PhD at Stanford, and he was telling me about this work done by this guy at Stanford named Claude Steele, and he was describing this concept known as stereotype threat. And long story short, stereotype threat is basically the experience where, in case you don't know, maybe you do, but stereotype threat for the listeners is let's say you are a woman who is stereotyped in our society as not being great at math, or you're a black person who's stereotyped as not being very intelligent. You go into a context and you think you're going to be stereotyped in this way. You get super anxious and nervous, and it kind of disrupts your academic performance. And it helps contribute to these disparities. So that kind of blew my mind, because it was the first time I saw how a researcher, a scientist, kind of quantified an experience that was so relevant and so real to me, of how our beliefs about what other people believe can, you know, create these false hierarchies. And that was just super powerful, and it was a very transformative moment for me, and I think that motivated me to want to take my interest that I've had for a long time and explore that in the world of psychology.
Yeah, and speaking about being inspired, I'm inspired by your work every single day. The fact that you connect the dots between race and between science, that's something that I completely admire and admire you doing. Now, talking about, you know, racial disparities, I know that you co-direct a lab called the Social Cognition and Development Lab at the Department of Psychology at Stanford University, which deals with how African-Americans are disadvantaged in religious places, social areas, and even during the scientific publication process. So you mentioned that you're half black, you're mixed in that regard. So being a half black psychologist, have you experienced some difficulties in terms of, you know, the scientific publication process or the educational process? And what are some issues that African Americans themselves generally face in these fields?
Well, that was interesting. So let's pause for a minute and let's talk about this. So I never identified as half black, and like, we actually do research on this. I'm actually writing a paper on this now. I think, so there's a tendency, for instance, for, if we think of, you know, famous multiracial people, how we, Obama, for instance, we think of people as half one and half the other. and we don't often think of them as, let's say, completely black and completely white. I think it's another way, I mean, it's something we all engage in. I engage in it, right, in it too. But that's one of the aspects that we study, where we tend to, you know, fragment or compartmentalize people based on their race in ways that isn't necessarily how they self-identify. So that's actually one area of research that we engage in. Right, we don't commonly think of people, let's say me, I have a black parent and a white parent. Now, most people would not allow me to switch my identity, to say that I'm black in this context or white in this context, or that I'm completely both, right? For instance, I'm also a German citizen and an American citizen. So technically I'm completely German and completely American, mm-hmm. but we wouldn't say that I'm half German, half American, mm-hmm. but we don't give people the same luxury in the domain of race, which I think is interesting, right? Yeah, so that's one aspect, one thing that we study. Now, to your broader point. Go ahead. I wanted to give you a minute to comment.
Yeah, no, I think that's extremely interesting, because, you know, we talked with Dr. Neil Lester, and we bring this up, you know, occasionally on the podcast, and I think that you have a lot of similarities with him in the sense that you like to talk about issues that aren't really seen, per se, kind of things that aren't really discussed. And I think that what you just brought up is one of those things that isn't really discussed, and it's something that we go on in our daily lives, and we engage in, but yet we don't really understand or see different points of views around it.
I think it's really great that you're thinking about it in that way, because, you know, many people would, you know, if I, for instance, would kind of call you out and say, hey, well, technically that's not really what I said, and I think it's a kind of reflects a deep way in which we think about race. I think a lot of people would be offended by that and think that I'm calling them racist or whatever, so I'm glad you didn't do that, because that's not at all what I'm saying. So one thing related to that, what we do in my lab is we do study racism, but we define racism as a system of advantage based on race. So racism right. is not, contrary to popular belief, one person hating another person. Racism we define as a system, an institution that we were all, in the United States, all born into. We've inherited certain beliefs, and we've just learned to navigate the world in a way that reinforces the system. Just how we live in a capitalistic society, irrespective of whether or not we identify as capitalists or not, our behaviors, nonetheless, by participating in the economic system, contributes to capitalism. So if we live in a society that's racist, we're obviously going to inherit racist beliefs and learn to reinforce that system, even if we don't want to. So to the point of, okay, is someone half this, half that? We do work in other domains. You mentioned religious racism in the religious sphere. We do a lot of work on how, you know, something that I think we often take for granted. For instance, in the United States, we get bombarded with this image of a white male God, right? So it's a very Christian nation. Google God right now, you'll see about 76 to 80% of the images portray God as a white male. Now, we kind of joke about that, think it's, you know, funny, it's ridiculous. You know, but that image that we're constantly exposed to actually feeds into how we perceive actual human beings. If from childhood you're taught that the ruler of the universe, the person who has created everything and is the most powerful person, entity of all time, is white and male, well, that licenses the belief that white males are, in fact, more high status and leadership mm-hmm. worthy than women and people of color. And this is, you know, something that we found experimental support from with preschoolers and black Christians, white Christians, men, women. So pretty confident in that that's a problematic belief. You mentioned, you know, racism in science. We also have a lot of data to suggest that, well, if you look at the past 50 years within psychology, who is in control of the scientific process, specifically who edits the major journals? And these editors, they basically determine what's worthy of being published and what isn't, what's interesting, what isn't. Well, if you look, for instance, in cognitive psychology, from 1974 to 2018, across two of the major cognitive psychology journals, all of the editors, 100%, have been white men, And we find that under white men, there have been fewer publications that talk about race and racism, and there have been fewer publications that have been published by women. So again, we're not saying that you know, someone who portrayed God as a white man or a white man in control of a journal is necessarily racist or that they hate someone of another group. But we are seeing that these images and these identities are embedded within a system that has consequences for who is allowed to stay on top and who is pushed toward the bottom. And we find that across a variety of spaces, things that you would not necessarily believe, including even romantic relationships. We find that also is structured by racism, and the rabbit hole is deep. So long story short, the rabbit hole is very deep.
Right. Right. I think that's systemic racism for you. A deep, deep, deep rabbit hole that really, really confounds every part of American society. Now, you talked about, you know, the fact that I said half black, and that I agree that it's very, that word itself was sometimes insensitive. It is. And that's part of being non-pacifist. The idea that you brought up in your study with Dr. Rizzo that identified seven key factors that continue racism in the U.S., one of them was pacifism, the fact that people are being too passive towards issues. And you know, me and Damien have believed that silence is complicity. The fact that people are being silent is advancing the issue and making it worse and worse. And I think that I recognize that things I say are not the most accepting, and I have a lot of flaws in what I say. So I appreciate you calling me out there and calling out my rhetoric, because that's really important to me. I want to become a better person and become more accepting. Now, one of the issues that, you know, Damien was talking about, little talked about issues, I wanted to talk to you about a very little talked about issue, and that is transracialism. Now, we've seen transgenderism over the years grow, and people have been accepting of it over the years. Obviously, it's not ideal right now in terms of acceptance, but we're talking about transracialism as an idea of people being nurtured as a person of different color. So, for example, a president of the NAACP chapter in one of the states in the U.S. named Rachel Dolezal came out as transracial, a white woman who basically identified as a black woman and changed her appearance to morph into that kind of segment. So, I wanted to ask you: do you believe that you know, the idea of nature versus nurture? Do you believe that nurture can influence a person's perception of themselves as in Rachel Dolezal's sense, a black person, even if they're white? And personally, as a person of color yourself, do you think that is okay? Because, I mean, a lot of people don't. You know, Rachel Dolezal is now living on the streets, living on food stamps, and out of her job, a high-paying job, as part of the NAACP. So where does the line lie psychologically and personally for you?
Well, I think it's a complicated concept, and, you know, it's still a highly debated one, and at the end of the day, we're talking about a series of socially constructed categories, so that have in fact changed over time, right? If you look at who's white today, those categories have definitely changed over time. Now, I'm going to put Rachel Dolezal aside for a minute, because I think she, as an individual, you know, she also lied about her family background.
Right.
She, as far as I know, intentionally darkened her skin. She curled her hair. So let's put Rachel aside for a minute, and let's talk about, okay, the broader topic of transracialism, of which we can think of different forms of transracialism. The sociologist Roger Burbacher has a great book on this called Trans. But let's just think, okay, broadly about, can an individual change their race? Or also, what is race? You know, that's kind of what you're also asking.
Right.
What is race? Now, if you commit to the idea that race is a biological reality, then, of course, you're going to say, yeah, that race can't change. Okay, now, if you believe that race is socially constructed, well, maybe that gives a bit more flexibility. Let me ask you a question. So imagine that a child is born in a hospital, and the child comes out, and the child looks white, is categorized as white, and goes home with two white parents, right? And is raised as white. And let's say 18 years later, they get an email from the hospital, and the hospital says, hey, actually, we made a mistake. You were accidentally switched at birth, and your biological parents are actually black. You just have this rare skin condition that makes you look white. Now, would you categorize that person as white or black?
Personally, I would categorize them as white.
Yeah. Let's have you both say your answer at the same time. I'm going to count down. 3, 2, 1, go. 3, 2, 1,
I don't know. I really, okay, damn. I don't know because what I was going to say is race is a weird thing because you know we talked again with Dr. Mason and Dr. Mason goes with the fact that race is not a biological fact.
Yeah.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Sorry. So yeah, that race isn't a biological fact. Now, I was kind of tying my personal stories into this, not to get off track, but I noticed that when, you know, I'm Hispanic and when I'm around my Hispanic cousins, typically in Texas, and they live closer to the south, you know, the south of Texas, more to the west, even the way that I talk changes. Hmm. So there I would be, you know, they consider me in that sense more Hispanic. But to them, I am also considered whitewashed because mm-hmm. I live in a city. I don't partake in Hispanic, you know, culture. My girlfriend is white. So to them, in that sense, I'm considered whitewashed. However, when I'm with them, my girlfriend would be like, oh, you're talking like a Hispanic person now. Like my accent changes, even like certain things that I don't even notice, my posture. I kind of fit into that side. I guess I would say side of me, if that's mm-hmm. even correct.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, first of all, technically, I could speak German, for instance, and still be black, right? So, I mean, just because you yeah. speak a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not whatever you identify as. But we definitely often mm-hmm. conflate the two. We associate these social properties with these racial and ethnic categories. Now, I want to ask you one more question, especially Amy, and looking forward to your answer here really quickly. Imagine, let's go back to this hospital. Let's say there's another baby born, black skin, looks dark, goes home with two black parents, raised as black there for whatever most of their life. They get an email from the hospital. The hospital says, hey, actually, you switched at birth. Your biological parents were white. You just have this rare skin disorder that makes you look dark. What race is this person? Black or white?
I would still say black.
Again,
Damien, what would you say?
I'd say that this, I mean, race is just such a weird, I'd say that this person is truly, and I think this is probably the oddest thing that I find myself saying, but this person is who they identify as. I think, and unfortunately, more so maybe even than that, it's who society identifies them as. I don't think that maybe a birth certificate really matters in that sense. They could say that they're black, but if society thinks that you're white, then what does it matter? It kind of brings me back, you know, not to get dissuade here, but you know, when Eminem gave a speech at the awards, there was a lot of white people coming out. He's not white anymore. He's black now. We don't want him.
Yeah.
And it was an odd situation where it's like you're just pushing someone out of your like. Is that, can you do that? But societally, I'm assuming, like taking all of this into account, it's what society deems you as.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly similar to what I believe, that, you know, we often have this conversation about, okay, can someone change their race? Well, the matter is, well, what do you think race is? And it varies depending on if you're thinking about race as biological, as socially, it varies depending on the race we're talking about. And that second example, the person who looks black and has white parents, most people, especially black people, will say that that person's black. But in the other case, which is just literally the reverse, where we just switch the races, most people will there say that person's not white, that person's also black. So it varies depending on what race are we talking about, what's your own relationship to that race, and importantly, Damien, to your point, how does society determine your own group membership? Now, if the black community, there's research on this, but if the black community would collectively say, we accept Rachel Dolezal, then of course Rachel Dolezal will be black.
Right.
But, I mean, for Rachel, for various reasons, that didn't happen. Now, people also, for instance, one of the first presidents, if not the first president, I should know this, Walter White of the NAACP, looked white, was in many ways treated as white. I think he had maybe one black great grandparent or something like that. But by virtue of, you know, how he behaved in society and what he did, he was embraced by the black community and considered black. long story short, it depends on who you're asking and what information we're using to make that decision.
Yeah, and an interesting idea to this point. I don't know why this reminded me of it, but it's almost a sense of brotherhood. And it reminds me of it's Obama and Hillary Clinton being interviewed, and they ask Obama, a lot of people have said something about Bill Clinton being black or something like that. And Obama responds, I'd have to evaluate his dancing skills, his rapping skills, and certain like stereotypical attributes that are given to an African-American person. And then at that point, I would be able to determine whether or not he is a brother. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's odd because in that sense, I get what you're saying in relationship to the first president. I believe it was the NAACP that you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it reminds me of the experience you have with maybe your cousins. If you know, we often expect people to, these aren't just arbitrary categories. We associate them with stereotypes or properties. And often we use those properties or stereotypes to kind of see if someone is truly a group member, but not always. We have these really interesting studies where we find that if you, on average, tell U.S. Black Americans about someone who looks white, is racist white, quote unquote, talks white, identifies as white, experienced a lifetime of white privilege, but their biological parents were black, Black people the majority will say that that person is definitely black. And one of the reasons for that is in the United States, black being descended from black people, having black ancestors, is being connected to a very particular experience in U.S. society, one that involves intense oppression and hardship. We're talking about slavery, Jim Crow. And from the perspective of black Americans, at least our research would suggest that if someone is connected to those past experiences, even if they don't have the dance moves today, even if they don't have the language today, if you're connected through to the same struggle of the past, you will always be a member of the group. And that extends also beyond black Americans. There's data on this with Jewish people, Jewish Americans, who feel connected to oppression that happened centuries ago, decades ago, still feel that anyone connected to that today is part of the same collective. You know, and we refer specifically, if someone is connected to the same collective memory, even if they didn't form that memory directly, but our ancestors generations ago experienced the same thing, then we'll always be part of the same collective, no matter what happens today. And bring it back to Rachel Dolezal, maybe one reason why she's not black is because she's not connected to that history.
Wow. And I've never thought of it that way. That's absolutely a different idea than what I thought of, and you've enlightened my perspective. Now, I think that personally, in-group bias, like you're talking about, is partly influenced by politics. Because back in the Nixon administration, after FDR's New Deal, we had poor whites and poor blacks just working together, and there was no sort of lessen discrimination between these groups. And after the Nixon administration used policies to gain the poor white vote, they used racism explicitly to gain that vote. They wanted to differentiate poor whites from black people. And that's, I think, that is kind of a reason for why in-group bias exists today and why it existed back then. So how deep-rooted is this bias within politics? Is it more of a psychological thing, or is it influenced by politics?
Well, I think the answer is both. But I'll focus on the psychological piece because we obviously see evidence for in-group biases all over the world. If you look at, you know, what happened in the Rwanda genocide, if you look at what's happening currently in China, if you look at Germany, how, you know, refugees or Syrian refugees are treated, I think you can find in-group versus out-group biases virtually on every aspect of the planet. And some, you know, many psychologists, there's a long literature on this now, would argue that that's rooted in what is scientifically referred to as the minimal groups phenomenon. And here's an example of what this would look like in an experiment. If you take a little kid, a four-year-old, into a lab, or take a few four-year-olds into a lab, and you flip a coin, and based on the coin flip, you put one in one group and one in the other group. So it's completely random, completely arbitrary. They're aware of that. One group gets these little green shirts, one group gets these little orange shirts. Pretty immediately, let's say the kids in the green group, they are more trusting of their own in-group members. They respect their in-group members more. They're more loyal to them. They're more willing to compete and reprimand out-group members. And the argument is that we're a very tribalistic species, we humans, and there's strength in groups. You know, there's groups are important for our own learning, for our own functioning. You need groups. We can't survive as individuals. So we kind of have this, some would argue, innate tendency to seek out our own tribes and our own groups. Now, that doesn't mean that in-group biases on the basis of race is legitimized, because if we've already established that, you know, these racial categories are not biologically factual, right? They're these socially constructed categories that have been created for a political purpose. But if we now have this innate tendency to seek out our tribes, and I now enter the world, and on my birth certificate, like Damian said earlier, it says that I belong to this certain racial tribe, well, I'm going to feel that affinity and that affiliation on the basis of that constructed group membership that I was given. Now, of course, you know, politicians, people are aware of this, and you could feed into that fire to really maximize that in-group tension, and that just heightens it. So I think that although it's certainly heightened by political biases and motivations, it's rooted in a deeper phenomenon that dates back throughout our evolutionary history.
Right, and before you say what you're going to say, Damian, I wanted to bring up one point from my studies in psychology. From AP Psychology, I learned that the one way they taught me that you can eliminate in-group bias is by people working towards a similar goal. You know, like you said, these orange and blue, I believe, people working towards one goal may kind of cut back upon that in-group bias. Now, that, I just thought of it, and this is kind of revolutionary in my mind right now. My mind is spinning in 10 directions, but the fact that during the New Deal, poor whites and blacks were working together towards economic equity, that may have kind of bridged that gap during that period. What do you think about that, Dr. Roberts?
I think that's completely accurate. Well, one thing that defines a group is having, I mean, we mentioned earlier, a common history, but also having a common future, a common goal. And if my goal, even we as individuals, if my goal is fundamentally opposed, I believe, if I believe it's fundamentally opposed to your goal, then now we're competitors. But if we're working toward the same goal, now we're collaborators. We have to collaborate. We're part of the same community. And that gets us to see each other no longer as, you know, in-group and out-group members necessarily, but as members of the same collective. The problem is, and especially in today's society, the more polarized we become, the less harder it is to see what goals we are collectively moving toward.
Yeah, and as you bring that up, Dr. Roberts, we can imagine that you're extremely busy, and you know, you were scheduled for a 30-minute interview here, and you have really blown our minds within that 30-minute, and we hope that we can continue this conversation on another day. I really enjoyed you coming on the podcast. I want to thank you. But as we do with all our guests, we want to ask you one final question, and that is, if you had one thing, quote, message from you to America's youth, what would that be? And you can take your time on this.
The question would be, when's the last time you did something that challenged systemic racism? And if it takes you more than 5 seconds to think of something, well, maybe you have some reflecting to do, and I hope you commit to some anti-racist action in the near future.
Wow.
Awesome. That's amazing. Wow. That's extremely empowering, and as we do all the time, we incentivize all of our listeners to go and do you know, have these community acts and act as a community, ask questions that are tough, that aren't easy, whether it's with your family, whether it's in a classroom setting with friends. Go out and you know, ask people. But we'll be right back after a quick message from our sponsors. All right, Dr. Roberts. Thank
hey,
you.
That
was that was. And we're back, and I was about to have a conversation with you, Varun, but I was like, why don't we just record it either way? We're back from our interview with Dr. Yeah. Roberts. But I was just going to say, the last question there, it was very impactful. It was, you know, what have you done to fight the systemic racism? And if you can't answer that in 5 seconds, you know, you have to kind of reevaluate and make sure that you're doing something to fight the system. And I thought about it in 5 seconds, and I was like, this interview, like it was very enlightening, mm-hmm. to know that, you know, oftentimes when you're doing the podcast,
obviously we know that we're doing something good. At least I do. I think we can both say that we know that we're doing something good.
Yeah.
But we don't do it with, I don't think that we do it with the intention of like, of trying, we don't go and we're like, oh, we're going to change the world. Like by talking to people or like, whoa, we're fighting the system. Like every time that we sign into Politatine, it's just, but it, in retrospect, when you look back and you see that you're having conversations that maybe one person's picking up on, and hell, even if that person is me or you, it's very interesting to see that that one, at least one mind is being changed. And in a sense, by changing at least one mind, I guess in turn you're fighting the system.
Well, talking about one mind that has changed is mine. You know, I've changed as a result of these conversations. When I was thinking about that question, like 2 years ago, I would have been, what is systemic racism? Like, I wouldn't have known what that term meant. And now that I'm on the podcast, I not only know what that term means, but I know what I'm doing to stop it. And I think that having these conversations for anybody, it's the most basic way to stop an issue that you're passionate about. Because when we're talking about having conversations with people of color, people of importance, people of political leadership, it always results in a more educated standpoint. You know, in Dr. Roberts' own research itself, it says that, you know, a lot of the times white parents or people of even people of color parents, they put their children in communities that basically reflect themselves. So, for example, if a white mother put her children in a community that was all white, and he's never seen a black person before he entered the workforce, he's obviously going to have that kind of in-group bias towards him. But on the other hand, if you listen to conversations or have conversations with people of color, you understand that they're not different. You know, it's the same exact person. So I think every form of acceptance starts with conversation, whether it's educated conversation, whether it's conversation in general, or whether it's just having fun. And I think we do a little bit of both here. We have fun, we have educated conversations, and we definitely learn things. And that's what makes us different.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of this, while you were talking, I was thinking about the research that Julia did. And we mentioned, obviously, that after the fact to Dr. Roberts. But I was thinking maybe we could do something like with our Patreon, where if you join our Patreon, which you guys can join, it's only $2 and you get a bonus episode. And I don't know about you guys, that sounds pretty good. And you're also helping create amazing content and supporting the creators that you guys love. And that is saying that you guys love our content. But of course you do. I mean, who are we kidding?
Course.
Either way, I was thinking.
There's no alternative. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe under that $2 line, you know, our viewers can let us know, tweet at us, or you know, join our Discord on Patreon once again. But maybe under that $2 line, we can also give access to research and early research, and you guys can kind of see what we know about the guests before we even have them on.
Yeah.
And I think that this would be something that's very interesting about this episode because this, you know, Dr. Roberts' research was very extensive and there's a lot of questions that we didn't get to ask him. And I say that because I wanted to ask him and I want to know, like, our listeners and obviously your perspective on this, but, like, you know, he talks about under the theme of power. And you won't understand – the reason that I'm saying this is you won't understand it without the research. So, so you know, me and Varun will figure something out for you guys and we'll try to get that research on Patreon. Yeah. But either way, under the theme of power, under those seven themes that Dr. Robert and I think it was Dr. Rizzo write about, the theme of power, it says that white parents, you know, it was kind of what you were mentioning, that white parents put their kids in communities that reflect themselves and kind of not only reflect themselves but reflect bad ideas on African-American individuals or individuals of other races. Now, what I'm thinking here, and this isn't an opinion and this isn't something that, like, that I can get misconstrued about. This is an actual fact. Black parents and Hispanic parents, I believe, also do this as well, where they say, you know, oh, the white person is dangerous. The white man is dangerous. The white woman's dangerous. Be careful. So it's interesting to see how both communities kind of do this.
Well, you know what? That's why I said people of color along with white.
Yeah.
And I didn't stop saying white. I said people of color also do it because that's what people don't mention. It's a little spoken idea that people of color also kind of conform to those racial tensions, conform to that racial division by having that in-group bias. And in-group bias, I mean, from a psychological standpoint, is the idea that people attract to people like them, you know, people who are similar to them. And I think that the issue right now is because we don't have a similar purpose. What's happening right now in our democracy is we have the law and order rhetoric, which is proposed by President Trump and the Republicans in Congress. Now, Damien, what's interesting is that back when Nixon and Reagan proposed that law and order rhetoric is that the people behind that law and order, I don't know if it's happening right now, but they were more correlated with racial divisions. They didn't like, you know, African-Americans, people of color, than they were actually, you know, passionate about law and order. So that idea in and of itself is racial discrimination, which people don't understand. So I think that they're fighting towards a goal, which they think African-Americans are impeding upon by being African-Americans. They think that, you know, people of color are inciting crime by simply being born into who they are. So the issue right now is that we have two different motives, and that we're in a sense, we all want law and order. You know, who doesn't want order? Who doesn't want a lower crime rate? But the fact of the matter is that people think that African-Americans are against law and order, and that is the issue. We have to create a sense of a similar goal, as I talked about, because psychologically, educationally, scientifically, the only reason to stop this in-group bias is by creating a similar goal, like FDR did with the New Deal, that protrudes these kinds of racial divisions.
Yeah, well, I think the racial divisions are being protruded, and ironically, the common goal is defeat this law and order, and if you get what I'm saying. People are coming together to stop the racial goal. It's kind of the goal. It's a kind of a paradox sort of thing. It's kind of the opposite of a paradox, I suppose, where the goal is to stop racial tensions, and therefore communities are coming together to stop those racial tensions. The goal is to, you know, remove a president with racist rhetoric out of the Oval Office, and communities are coming together, and hopefully we'll see that on November 3rd. And people are going to vote in order to do that. So in a sense, I think that we are getting a common goal, but it's unfortunate that that common goal is to oppose that leadership as opposed to coming from the leadership. But either way, something very interesting that I definitely want to talk to you about is what I really learned. I think sometimes you know things without knowing them, if you get what I'm saying. Like, you're aware of, or you know, how do I say it?
Here's what I'm like, gonna, you're I, here's aware what I think you're of something. Saying. Are you saying that people have biases that they don't recognize inside of them?
No. I was going on the point, I was going to say that I knew that, like, race was a social construct, but I suppose I wasn't aware to what extent.
You were
I think
passive
that's the best
it.
Way of.
Passivism.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Almost passive towards it. Like, it was in the back of my mind, like, but, like, having that conversation where he posed those two, you know, those two hypotheticals where it was, you know, a quote unquote, a white kid, you know, with more melanin or whatever rare disorder, he mentioned, the hypothetical rare disorder that is, going home to a black family and then 18 years later getting the phone call saying that he's actually white and just has a rare disorder, would he be considered black? And I think that my answer to that question was something that I didn't even know that I could answer. Do you get what I'm saying? Like,
well,
it was just weird.
Too.
It was weird for me to answer it in that sense, where it was like, it's unfortunate that race isn't biological. It's not personal, but rather it's societal. And to what extent is very odd, where your own race is determined by society.
Yeah. No, it's very, very odd. And the reason why, you know, I said, answer both questions with one word. I said white and I said black. But the problem is I never realized why I said them. The fact of the matter is that I was so definite in my answer that I never had an explanation. Like, I knew what my answer was 100%, but I had no idea why I knew that, if you get what I'm saying. And
yeah,
what
no,
you,
I agree with
yeah.
that.
And what you said about how, you know, not to cut you off or anything, but what you said about how white people and black people are categorized more by what society thinks of them than by their biological standpoint is what I really believe in my heart of hearts. But I kind of regressed that idea. It was passive to me. I had no idea I had it. So I think having conversation pulls out things that you don't ever know about yourself. It's more of a personal discovery stage that we're facing right now. I'm facing especially. I think maybe you are as well, but like personal discovery in terms of the podcast. But you know, one of the ideas, talking about, you know, backbone ideas that we don't mention on the podcast that I wanted to mention, I was dying to mention in that 30-minute conversation, was the fact of residential discrimination. And that's one thing that I've faced a lot, especially in Forsyth County. The fact that a lot of people in our area especially discriminate against people of low income status by not guaranteeing them residential status. Like doctor, not doctor, but Mr. I forgot what our last guest name was. I'm forgetting.
Was it Jason Boski?
Jason Boski. Yeah. Jason
Boski. Boski. God, I keep it. I wrote that on the top of my page.
Yeah.
I wrote it as B-O-S-S-K-K. Look at me. K-E-Y. So it was Boski. And he really is a boss.
He really
was an awesome interview. We really recommend that you guys listen to that. That is maybe we after the podcast we referred to him as the Donald Glover, the white Donald Glover, I think, in between all of us. So it was a great conversation that we had, and we definitely recommend that you guys go listen to it. And go ahead though, Brent.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Jason Bosky brought up the fact that Forsyth County, Georgia, doesn't give people low-income housing because of that suburbanite mental status. Now, I think suburbanite, that kind of suburban status where I don't want these low-income people in my neighborhood, they increase crime, as Trump said, that's completely racist. And that's implicitly racist, explicitly and implicitly. So having these biases just shows me that we don't have a common goal. A lot of us do, Damien, you're right. But we don't all have that same common goal. And I'm going to end on this. Yesterday, I was talking to a friend in a car, and we were talking about politics. And I was talking about how, you know, the majority of blacks are in low-income communities, right? And that's a problem we have to solve. Now, what he said was, Varun, you're being racist by saying that blacks are low-income. Now, I said, no, that's statistically proven, right? We have to recognize that. And you know, it's a valid argument. You know, if you have two conservatives in a bar and they're saying, oh, it's racist if you say black people are poor, well, no. It's statistically proven that they're the most, well, them and the Hispanics are the most poor people in America in terms of percentages. So we have to recognize that in terms of pacifism and not just say that's racism. Because in reality, it's science. It's facts.
Yeah, well, I think kind of shutting it down as racism right away is pacifism. Like, hey, we can't talk about the fact that African Americans and that black people and that Hispanics are poor because that's kind of racist. Even though, like, inherently, the reason that they are poor is because of a lack of acknowledgement of that very fact. So if, when you go to acknowledge the fact that, hey, the African-American community disproportionately faces low income, or disproportionately suffers, if you will, I wouldn't say suffers, but it is subject to low income, mm-hmm. As opposed to typical white households, then you can really progress and say, okay, how do we solve this then? Yeah. What is the issue? Where can we get to the root of this? But by not acknowledging it and just deeming it as racism and moving away from the conversation, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot and perpetually kind of keep this whole idea of you know, again, blacks and minorities being subject to low income. But either way, on this very subject, I was listening to the Michelle Obama podcast. Very, very good podcast. Right. We highly recommend it. But I was listening to this idea, and I wanted to bring this on with Jason. But the idea was the fact that, you know, everyone references white flight. I think it was in the 80s, right? White flight in the 80s.
Yeah.
Where white people leave and they would go to the suburbs. But she mentions that it wasn't just white flight. It was black flight, too. The black people that could get out of that could afford to go to the suburbs left. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting here is that the white people that also couldn't afford to go to the suburbs would stay with what was considered, you know, if you're deeming it white flight, they would stay with the black people. So certain black people that had the financial means to leave to the suburbs got to leave with all the white people, and certain white people that didn't have the financial means had to stay with all the black people per se, right? Under this characterization of the white flight, to use that term technically, right? So an interesting point on this is the fact that the community was no longer, I mean, even in that sense, obviously there was still racism when those African Americans would follow the white people, not follow, but move into the suburbs with white people. You know, they would still face oppression and whatnot. But it was even there, even in those communities and more progressive communities, you saw the acceptance of the black and white people, and they would kind of merge, and it was a merging of race because of the idea that they all had money. While you still saw African, and then the discrimination was rich versus poor,
what's
wealthy,
their goal now?
Half wealthy versus poor.
What's their goal now? Think about it.
Their goal is to have money.
Exactly. So, and the second goal they have, as you said, rich versus poor, is against the poor. Right? Mm-hmm. Because the poor versus, I think there's two forms of discrimination in the United States. It's poor versus rich and black versus white and other minorities, obviously, under that umbrella. But the fact of the matter is that what you're saying is absolutely right, because these white people and black people in these high status standpoints, they associated with themselves because of the fact that their goal was to oust the poor. Now, this is a similar goal to back when we live in Forsyth County, Georgia, and this is one of the most historically racist places in the United States of America, especially Georgia. And back in 1917, I don't know if you know this, Damien, but 1,100 black people left Forsyth County, Georgia, because of the fact that they were being lynched because of two crimes that happened. They were being lynched, unfairly trialed, hanged, executed. That's the fact of the matter. Part of it is that white people are leaving to the suburbs. Part of it is that white people were kicking out black people from the suburbs, and we're still doing it. You know, back then, it was doing it by violence, hanging, executing black people, lynching black people. Now, it's by President Trump saying that, you know, we want to protect suburbanites. We want to protect these communities from low-income housing. Well, low-income housing is primarily black, right? I'm not being racist by saying that. I'm statistically saying that based on research. And that's the most explicit racist thing that I've heard the president say. And residential segregation is something that we have to consider as a high modern form of segregation and discrimination.
Yeah, we definitely do have to consider that. And it's odd in the sense that that we just, I mean, I'm trying to gather my thoughts here, but it's a
difficult subject.
No, it most definitely is a difficult subject, but I'm trying to see where I can go with this. Because the fact of the matter is that unfortunately you do have African Americans, you know, living in that low income housing. But it's just the fact that what's astonishing to me, and this is kind of the idea that I was trying to capture here in my time thinking, is the fact that racism hasn't disappeared. It's just gotten creative. And it kind of goes back to the idea of that system, right? The system is inherently racist, but we don't notice it anymore because it's been so well hidden. And we're running off of legislation and ideas that were meant to be racist that we don't perceive as racist anymore. So at the time, they were intended to be just that. These laws were intended to remove African Americans. But as time progressed, we kind of forgot of the intention of these normal laws, and we just integrated them into our system. And we said, that's how it's always been.
Yeah.
You know, it's not
pacifism.
Racist. It's just how it's always been. So, so exactly. It's kind of like a pacifism, but it's not that the people are racist. It's not that the people that say, hey, we don't want, even if you say we don't want low income housing in our community, that's not racist. That's not racist, right? If I'm being mistaken, you can correct me, but I don't see saying, hey, I don't want low-income housing in my community. That's not racist because you know, at the end of the day, low-income housing at the very least apparently brings down the value of your home. That's right. You know, you can argue about the crime that it brings. You can argue about the drugs that it brings. But the issue is now that low-income housing is associated with African Americans as opposed to being associated with just poor people in general. So unfortunately, the racism isn't the people that don't want the low-income housing. It's the fact that the system has forced African Americans into low-income housing, thus making it appear like the people who are white and don't want that low-income housing are racist.
I think some of them are, Damien. I think some of them are.
No, definitely some
and
of them
right.
are racist.
Yeah, and you're right about everything that you said. Because part of it is not white people, but you know, people in these communities trying to protect their house's price. But part of it is these people just thinking about, you know, low-income housing means more black people. And more black people means more crime. And that's just how it is. That's how it's always been. Right? And that's what they continue to say. Now, you know, the problem is that they're pacifists to the idea that what they're saying, in a sense, supports racism. Because it supports that discrimination of people between residential areas. Now, we have to fix that. We have to find a solution to that. And, you know, Joe Biden promises to end suburbs, to end the idea that suburbs are different than low-income housing. And that's admirable in a sense, but we have to – I've never thought of this in this sense. I've never even researched as much as I did today about this issue. But I think I have to do more research, as we all do. But in a sense, pacifism is being exhibited by these people. In these suburbanite areas, and I've been pacifist to it. For example, I want to talk about something in terms of our area that we're in right now, Forsyth County, Georgia. Now, in our school that we go to, I'm part of the principal's advisory board, and I saw a statistic that says, I think 23 African Americans in our school. And our school has, I don't know, over 700 kids, almost 1,000 kids in our school, and 23 of these kids are African American. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's just, there's, the people that I know, in a sense, I would say they act African American, which is really weird, right? Because, you know, we talk about,
quote unquote, kind of the conversation that we had, they act African American.
Right. they somehow act African American. But I'm looking at the statistics, and 23 people are actually African American in our school. But people just consistently say, oh, you act African American. Oh, you act black. You appropriate black culture. So the fact of the matter is that if we use so much black culture in our lives, why are we not okay with black culture, especially? You know, people are always like, oh, I don't want black culture in my neighborhood. I don't want this kind of mentality in my neighborhood. But the fact of the matter is that even with 23 people in our school, I mean, that isn't
changing. Black culture is rampant.
It is.
Yeah.
It's not going to change that.
Yeah, it's ooh, man, it's such an interesting conversation to kind of delve into. In the sense, I see what you're saying. I think a lot of people might not understand that. So to put it into layman's term, what Varun's saying is that even with the lack of African American representation in our school, mm-hmm. right? Let's say there was zero African Americans in our school, we would still see the presence of African American culture in our school because of the fact that it is so prominent in just American society.
Yeah. It took me a while to get there, but that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. So just to put it in those terms, because some people might be like, what's he saying? Black people act black.
You're right.
But interestingly enough, a lot of black people would say Obama acts white, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. they would say, you know, that's a white boy because of the way that he speaks, his speaking patterns. Obviously, there's cultures, and I suppose, again, it's just a conversation that I wish we could have Dr. Roberts here for, but is there – there is societally a term that is either acting black, acting white, acting Hispanic, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, those negative stereotypes of acting black are taken away, right? Because if you would say the stereotypes of acting black, it would be you know, it would typically be the slang, the dancing, the way that they wear their clothes, the music that they listen to. And then beyond that, when it's a black person, it's the fact that they either do drugs, they sell drugs, or they commit crimes, right? Mm-hmm. But when it's a white person, it's just a white person acting black, and you get rid of the last three.
Yeah,
you get rid of the crime, you get rid of the selling drugs or the doing drugs. I think in most situations, obviously, there's still some people that will. It's just such an odd term,
right? Yeah.
Because I think some people can still. I don't know. This is the way to put it. White people will always even if they act black, they have the possibility of having the exception that they don't do drugs, they aren't involved in crime. On the other hand, if black people act white, they will be attributed because of the color of their skin, the fact that they do drugs and or are partaking in crime. So it's a very interesting situation. Now, speaking of the representation in our school, and kind of going back to this whole idea, something that's interesting, and it goes back to this affordable housing. I don't think that the issue is that people don't want. How do I say it? I don't think that if in these communities, and this is the argument that I'm trying to make, Brune, if affordable housing, right? If affordable housing in a hypothetical, in a parallel universe. Right, affordable housing was actually a bunch of African American lawyers, doctors, principals, educators, county leaders, and they were moving into a community. I don't think people would be like, no, we don't want affordable housing in 2020.
Okay.
Right, I think obviously some people would still discriminate and say we don't want black people here. But I think that the people that say we don't want black people here will just say we don't want black people here.
Okay.
But the issue is that I feel like even black people living in the suburbs say we don't want affordable housing here. Because of the fact that affordable housing, unfortunately, has been stereotyped with bringing, regardless of the race, it has been, attributed to bring crime and to bring people with I guess I suppose again speaking, in their terms, people that are have malicious intent or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So the issue isn't again the racism. The issue is the fact that the people in affordable housing have been left behind. Now,
you're right.
The subjects of that affordable housing just happen to be black.
Well,
and that's the issue. They just happen to be black. So the solution here isn't how do we get black people out of affordable housing, right? It's how do we make affordable housing or those subject to affordable housing more appealing. Because what I'm trying to say in that parallel universe theory is that if if affordable housing was attributed the factor or attributed the subjects of doctors, of lawyers, of teachers, of governors, of mayors, then people would be okay with it. But since we have these negative stereotypes, I think regardless of the color of the skin of those who live in affordable housing, I think that there's white communities where they know that the affordable housing pertains to white communities. Obviously, when you think about in slavery, the last person on the list, even below slaves, was white trash. White trash was always looked down upon, even by the white community, right? Even by the slaves themselves, they would be like, white trash was always looked down upon. So the issue is, how can we take away these factors from all low-income housing to make low-income housing seem more appealing? I'm not trying to say make African-Americans seem more appealing, right? That's not what I'm trying to say. So don't understand it in that term. I'm trying to say, how can we make, whether they're white, black, Hispanic, Latino, Asian, how can we make anyone who's coined the term, or anyone who has the term attached to them, of low income, how can we make them more educated? And it's not their fault. They're not less educated because they're black. They're less educated because of a system that has oppressed them and taken that education away from them. So now the question is, how can we educate them more?
I think they are less educated because of the fact that they're black. I'm saying this because in our society today, here's the stance that some people take in their entire life.
Well, Varun, I meant biologically. Like, you know how some people say black people are smart, dumber.
That's what you're saying.
You get it now. Yeah, obviously, because they're black, they are in that sense left behind, and therefore they're dumber.
Well, I think that
But I'm not saying. But white people in the same situation are also dumber because of the fact that they have been left behind. But go ahead.
I don't disagree with you. I'm saying there's more to the issue than I think that we're recognizing right now, because the fact of the matter is that a black person in a low income community sometimes. In the majority of circumstances, 30 to 60% of any black person across any board is arrested or implicated in a crime. And what happens with that, when you're a child or you're an adult, if you commit a crime and you're a black person, what happens is you lose your privileges. As I said before, over and over and over again, you lose the right to vote. You get disenfranchised. You lose job opportunities. You lose educational opportunities. Now, what happens is, more than that, your kids lose those opportunities because you leave a wife behind. Your wife's in these communities, she can't earn enough money, and your kid unfortunately has to suffer in this same status. So I think that it's a cycle of things. Black Americans are more left behind by our criminal justice system than they are by our systemic racism, and that's a form of systemic racism in and of itself. So to fix the low-income communities and to stop African Americans from resorting to crime in these communities, we have to fix the way that we police the streets. We have to look, like I said with Fannie Lewis, to diversion programs instead of actual arresting, instead of actual court times. We have to increase the amount of support we give to these communities, educational opportunities. We have to recognize that if a 15-year-old sells drugs on the street, he should not have to deal with the implications of his actions for his entire life. Now, the fact that you're bringing up these black people that have made it out into these communities, as some people say, the fact is they're not oblivious to what's happening right now. And some people pretend that they are, but the fact of the matter is, at one point, their grandparents or their ancestors were subject to the same disenfranchisement, the same criminal justice system that faces black Americans today. And we have to reform that system before we can achieve any form of less criminal activity in these communities. Now, the fact of the matter is that, again, with this talking point, when a black person or any person of color gets out of jail, they lose these opportunities. And the fact of the matter is that it's very hard for them to resort back to their regular lives. They want to go back to crime, to be honest with you, because the criminal justice system never gives them that chance to flourish. Like Larry Lawton, he's a white person. He came out of jail after 11 years. His first instinct was to go back to crime. He legitimately wanted to go back to jail because he had too much choice. And our criminal justice system does not give him that educational opportunity to become a better person. Now, and that's the system that we have to tackle for white people, but more specifically for people of color.
Yeah, well, it's going back on this subject, this idea that I was kind of talking about, where it's the fact that African Americans are more disproportionately given those circumstances, right? And they're more disproportionately given those circumstances of being in low income housing because of the fact that they were subject to, exactly, being arrested, being low income housing, all factors, I guess you would suppose, of low income housing, being involved more in crime. But they are only in that situation because of the fact that America left them behind. And America has always neglected them.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that if they would have been white people, right, if white people would have been used, if white people would have been left behind, the fact of the matter is that they, like you were saying with Larry Lawton, that they still have been left behind. The issue, it's not, from what I'm perceiving, obviously it is a black issue. The reason that they're there is because of the fact that they were African American and because they were discriminated against. But now it's an issue that we can only deal with by, you know, we have to acknowledge the fact that it was a black issue. But now we have to say, okay, because it's not just black people that are being disenfranchised anymore. It's white people that are really being disenfranchised as well. And white people that live in these low-income communities are also being subject to losing their right to vote, you know, suspended driver license, getting involved in crimes. And the issue is that they, in a sense, supposedly were also left behind by their society. You know, you might attribute weed more with the African-American community, but stereotypically, if I'm thinking low-income housing in a white community, I'm thinking of drugs like heroin. Or cocaine. Do you get what I'm saying here? Like, they have also been left behind, and they also have been disenfranchised. And I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that it's more disproportionately black, but that's not the issue. The issue is the fact that people have been left behind.
I'm going to ask you a question here. Do you think that if these communities were primarily white, that these arrested people would be disenfranchised, that they'd lose educational opportunities, that same things would happen to them? Because, I mean, I want you to answer that question first.
So if these low income communities were also
I think
that at the end of the day, right now in America in 2020, that if you had you know, if you had crackheads and heroin users living in affordable housing, right? I guess
well, think about
this.
I
completely get what you're saying, but I'm supposing.
I think the issue right now, Damien, talk about cocaine, right? So we talk about, and we're going over our time limit here. I want to keep talking about this though. The issue that I see right now is that, for example, crack and powder cocaine. Powder cocaine is used in white communities, primarily wealthy white communities, whereas crack cocaine is used in primarily low-income black communities because of its inexpensibility. But the chemical compound of cocaine is the same in crack and powder cocaine. So let me ask you this. Why is crack cocaine more heavily, you know, people are arrested with crack cocaine. People are put into larger prison sentences. They're almost put to the death sentences in certain perspectives with crack cocaine. But the same thing isn't happening with powder cocaine. So why is that?
Let me tell you this on the subject of the drug. In high income communities within African Americans, they're using powdered cocaine. Right. So if you have a rich African American attending a white party, they're using powdered cocaine and they're going to face the same sentence as a white person would. Now, on the other hand, if you have a white person using crack cocaine, right, in a low income community, they are also going to face the same consequences as an African American.
But
now the issue is the disproportionality.
Yeah,
disproportionality. Is the issue. The issue is that more African Americans are subject to use crack cocaine and more white people are subject to use powdered cocaine because of a racist system.
That's what I was trying to mention. Why is that disproportionality there? There's always exceptions to any rule, right? There's always going to be, but why is that disproportionality there? Because the system favors these white, wealthy people. But there's always going to be exceptions.
The system, Varun, I think This is what I've gathered. The system did favor, right? In a sense, it still does favor, and it favors white wealthy people because of the system's past actions, right?
Why are we changing
those
actions?
Now, sorry, what?
I think you're talking about past, but the fact of the matter is they're still there.
Yeah, no. That's what I'm saying, because we haven't acknowledged that past. As America, we haven't acknowledged that past. So once we acknowledge the fact that we left African Americans behind, and we put a system in place, let's say in the 60s, or let's go after the Civil War, we put a system in place to detain and arrest and disenfranchise African Americans, right? 100 years later, we touched it up a little bit. We fixed it a little bit with the Civil Rights Movement and you know, the Voting Rights Act. We touched it up, but then you have the Nixon and the Reagan era, right? And you kind of have, again, this war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on crime, and you kind of, you have legislation put into place that Joe Biden also put with his, you know, in incarcerating disproportionately African Americans. But the reason that even those laws were put into place and that affected African Americans at that time, you can say that it was racist, but moreover, it wouldn't have been as affecting, it wouldn't have affected African American communities disproportionately. Now, what I'm saying with disproportionately is the fact that 90% of these drug-related offenses that you're talking to are with regard to the African American community or with the Hispanic community, right? 90%. So it's 90% because of the fact that after slavery, they were disenfranchised and they were subject as second-class citizens. After the Voting Rights Act, they were only touched up a little bit. And now today, while we do not have inherent racism in our blood, and I don't think that a lot of us do, right? A lot of us don't have psychological inherent racism. The fact that we haven't fixed the system in the past and the wrongdoings of the system in the past is the reason that we still have the same disproportionality that we purposefully created. So the issue isn't why are we treating black people unfairly? It's how can we change the fact that black people are disproportionately treated unfairly in comparison to white people because of the fact that we did wrongs in the past, right? So you have to find a solution to, I mean, it sounds bad, but you have to find a solution to even the odds, right? And evening the odds, as we discussed with Jason, privilege is bringing, we don't want to bring white people down to the level of African Americans and have them subject to the same sort of environment that they are. We actually want to bring African Americans up to the I wouldn't say privilege. We want to have everyone on the same starting point. So it's how do we get everyone on that same starting point, right? Now, because they were left behind, we can't. They're not on the same starting point, right? They're not. So we gotta. It's not racist now. It's past racism in the system that creates this disproportionality. So we have to fix the disproportionality. And in doing so, therefore, fix the low-income housing situation.
Yeah, and it's I'm gonna, you know, end on this. We have a couple of minutes left here. We talk about this later. I disagree. I'm going to disagree, and that's okay because we have these kind of conversations for a reason. I think it's racism today. I think it was racism back then, and I say that because back then we had the word crime. People who use the word crime, law and order rhetoric. They surveyed these people, and these people didn't have aversion towards crime, but they had an aversion towards black people. They didn't believe strongly in law and order. They believed strongly in discriminating against black people. That was a survey done back then. And the fact of the matter is that the same results uphold right now. President Trump uses the rhetoric law and order in a sense to just put down black communities, and that continues to happen. The war on drugs, they never reformed anything. There was no drug reforms put in place. For example, Portugal had drug reforms put in place, decriminalized all drugs, and the drug rates went down. But we did none of that. All we did was increase police forces, increase brute force, increase arrests, increase convictions. We never put a single law in place during the Nixon and Reagan administration that cut into reform on drugs. We never did. And the reason why we did then, and we continue to do that now, is because we don't want to fix the issue. We want to have people as drug dealers, and I believe this strongly, that's a personal opinion, so that we can continue to place these people within the arresting system, to arrest them, to place them within that flawed systemic racist system. So I think racism is well and alive today, and you're right, in a sense, people don't recognize that. They're passive towards it. They don't know they're racist, but they still are, in my perspective. Being passive is in a sense, in other sense, in my perspective, being racist. And I'm going to end on that, and we can talk about this later on. But I love today's conversation, Damien. I think it was one of our most passionate and one of our best, to be honest with you.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree in the sense that if we're going to say pacifism is an attribution to racism, it most definitely is. And to avoid that pacifism, we have to have conversations. And as we end, you know, all of our podcasts, go out and have a conversation. Go out and have uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah.
I think maybe for a lot of people listening that might not understand, this might be an uncomfortable conversation.
Yeah, and
it might be. It might be. Yeah, and even for us in certain sense, you know, at times I was saying stuff that I probably wouldn't have said a year ago, right? Or maybe I have a different take. And I think that every day I can have a different take on certain issues. And maybe tomorrow I'll agree with Varun on this sense because I can see where he's coming from. But we won't understand where we're coming from if we don't have conversations, ladies and gentlemen. So once again, please go out and have conversations, whether it's with your family, with your friends, at a dinner table, you know, obviously socially distanced right now, put on your mask to have any conversations, but have them over the phone if you can. Stay safe. And as always, thank you for listening to another episode of Politatine. Be sure to tune in this Wednesday for the next episode. And thank you all for listening.
One more thing before we end out here. You know, start the conversation by saying, what have you done to stop systemic racism, like Dr. Roberts said today? And that's what I want to end on. And we can continue this next Wednesday. Thank you guys so much. Yeah. Have a great day.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politatine podcast. As always, we appreciate and thank you for your support over these past couple of weeks as we've grown as a podcast and as a duo between myself and Damien. And please follow us on Twitter at Politatine Show. And always, as always, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Politatine Show and to connect with us via email at politatinepodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to check out our newly hosted website at politatinepodcast.com. And lastly, please consider becoming a sponsor, a donor for our campaign on Patreon. You can get a link to that through our website at www.politatinepodcast.com. And through becoming a sponsor, you can get some amazing exclusive perks such as a way to contact us for questions, suggestions, becoming part of our exclusive community where you can kind of talk about your political viewpoints and ask questions of our guests as they come on. You know, live streams of us talking and even posters, stickers to rep Politatine. So as always, have a great rest of your day and thank you so much for your support over these past couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much.